integrity in each of the services is also critical to a strong military. General Amos, I have become friends with Major James Wyrick, United States Marine Corps, who I sincerely believe is a man of integrity. Did you fear Major Wyrick at any point?
My name is James Wyrick, and this is Military Justice, my podcast about the system of justice that governs those who protect our nation. Welcome back to Military Justice. Thanks for joining us again. Today, we have a special treat. We have one of the greatest military justice scholars currently living. I'd put him alongside probably Colonels Dwight Sullivan and Fran Gilligan as the preeminent military justice scholars in the United States. We have Eugene Fidel of Yale Law School. And you attentive listeners will recognize the name from the Bo Bergdahl case. We don't mention Bo Bergdahl in this interview, and that was specific. I don't believe it's proper to discuss it with counsel during an ongoing case, so we limit our discussion to military justice and his new book, Military Justice, A Very Short Introduction. So, thanks to the people at Blue Apron, we get to bring you this great interview. I hope you enjoy it. Professor, it's an honor to have you on the show today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Wyrick.
I've known of you, and I've known you for a number of years now, but if you could take the listener from your decision to become a judge advocate through today, and I will note for all of the audience, this is a coastie we have on. I am doing everything I can to make up for the times I have missed our members of the Coast Guard.
Well, you're darn right, pal. So my own military history is that I joined the U.S. Coast Guard after law school. I graduated law school in 1968. The draft had obviously a strong impact on my planning and planning of many other guys. I joined the Coast Guard mostly because my dear brother, also a lawyer, was at the time a Coast Guard law specialist. That was coastie for judge advocate. And I was impressed by the experience that he was having on active duty. That's actually why I wound up in the Coast Guard. And I wound up serving 3 years, 7 months, and 8 days on active duty. I had a very positive experience. I went to Naval Justice School and served at the Marine Inspection Office in Los Angeles, Long Beach. Then I was transferred to the 1st Coast Guard District after having attended Naval Justice School. I was a junior lawyer in the district commander's staff for 2 years, and then for my last 11 months, I was transferred to Coast Guard headquarters, where I was assistant and then acting chief of the Maritime Laws and Treaties Branch, which basically was the tiny little office that at the time was responsible for maritime law enforcement, including drugs and fisheries, and had a fantastic experience there. Worked with terrific people, particularly in Boston, made lifelong friends, and it was a great experience.
You've remained in military law ever since, is that correct?
That's true. When I left active duty, it wasn't workable, really, to be in the drilling reserves. I had gone back to the law firm that I'd been with for a few months right after law school. I was offered a position in Flag Plot, which is the 24/7 command center for the commandant, and that was not legal work, and I thought that my time was better spent both on my job as well as doing scholarly work, which I began immediately after leaving active duty. Actually, I was doing professional writing while I was still on active duty. I think I had one or two pieces published when I was a lieutenant on active duty. But I wound up spending, as a young bachelor in Washington, D.C., spending a lot of time in the law library on weekends and in evenings working on law review articles.
And I think that's my first introduction to you is when I was doing appellate government work for the Navy and Marine Corps. And I found your guides to CAF litigation, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, invaluable.
Well, I'm glad to know that. Dwight Sullivan and I have been putting that out for a number of years. We really don't know who reads it. I will say it's been a tremendously rewarding experience, number one, to really pull together these odds and ends of practice from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, and also to work with Dwight. Dwight and I have been collaborators and friends for many, many years, and that relationship is one of the most rewarding I've had.
Oh, he is a fine American and a incredible jurist.
Yeah, he's also, as I recall, a Marine.
Yes, he is. Yes, I didn't. We all went to Navy Justice School together, I believe, then.
I thought I'd drop that in.
So, speaking of publications, let's kind of work from the front to back to a certain extent. You very recently published Military Justice, A Very Short Introduction. And I've got to tell the readers, if you aren't exposed to military justice in any way, this is a great starting book. And when you say it's a very short introduction, it's also a very diminutive introduction. The book is actually small. You could put it in your back pocket. You could read it on the subway. It's really a nice intro. What prompted you to do this?
Well, first of all, Wyrick, you can throw it in your pack.
Yes.
I was asked to do it by Oxford University Press. Their editors are very entrepreneurial and intelligent people, obviously, and they felt that this was a need that their readers had, a burning need, right? And they asked me to do it. It took about 2 years longer than I anticipated, but they were very tolerant of me, and in the end, I was very happy with the product. It's a book with attitude. This is not a law review article. It's not a treatise. It's not, God forbid, you know, how to do a UA case. It's a distillation of things that I've been thinking about for a long time. And it's also really global. One of the things that I think is very exciting about the last, let's say, 10 years, maybe 15 years, is that it's now possible, thanks to the internet, to have a sense of global developments and trends. And Oxford is not solely oriented towards a U.S. audience. They try to meet the reader in other countries. So the idea of having a sort of global take on things was one that made sense for them. And it also responded to my own view, which is that this is a global set of issues. The outcomes may not be identical, obviously, from country to country, or to say cultural group to cultural group. But, you know, issues about how you run a disciplined, orderly military force come up in every country that has a military force. And, you know, there are a number of sort of flashpoints, basic policy choices, and countries go their various ways. You may agree, you may disagree. But it is possible to discern trends. So that's one of the things that I was anxious to share with readers. And so far, the reaction has been very positive.
And speaking of global, that definitely is a trend in your writing. And you created global military justice reform. And I'll make sure that this is in the show notes also for the reader. But that's at globalmjreform.blogspot.com. And I read that very regularly, and you can see from Pakistan to South America to the United States trends in military justice and where military justice is going in the future, I think.
Yeah, well, it may be going backwards. Who knows? It's an interesting and very, to me personally, worthwhile exercise. It does take some time to monitor news reports. Mostly the blog seeks to share information rather than give my own take on things, although a reader can figure out where I'm coming from without too much problem. I mean, there are some recurring issues that drive me crazy, and you'll see those both in the book that you mentioned as well as on the blog. Just to give a major one that is very much on my screen, no pun intended, it's the question of when a military court can properly try a civilian. And I've been watching events in Pakistan very closely because they are just unable to, I think, come down the right way on that, which is basically you never try civilians in a military court. There are other countries as well that just have gotten this this habit. Egypt is a prime example. Lebanon suffers from this. Uganda suffers from this. Cameroon suffers from this. Obviously, fewer cases, but still, I mean, they're prosecuting some journalists, I think, in Cameroon right now. So, you know, that's an issue that doesn't loom particularly large on the U.S. horizon, although we do, you know, in some very limited circumstances, prosecute civilians in a court-martial if you're serving with or accompanying an armed force in the field in time of declared war or...
And we've had maybe a handful of those.
Or contingency operation.
Right. A very small number of those, as far as I know, correct?
That's right. And, of course, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces upheld that jurisdiction in the Ali case a few years ago in an opinion that I think is flawed. But, you know, there it is. At least we don't do it very often. But other countries, even the U.K. does it. The U.K. had a case called the Queen Against Martin, where they prosecuted a dependent of a service member in Germany. And the House of Lords, their then Supreme Court, upheld it. The case went to the European Court of Human Rights on that and other grounds. And that court disallowed the proceedings because the UK court-martial system at the time was not impartial and independent, as the European Convention requires. But at the same time, the opinion of the European Court says, look, exercising military jurisdiction over civilian is disfavored, and you need standards that are knowable in advance, and so on. So obviously taking a very dim view of the exercise of military jurisdiction over civilians.
This episode of Military Justice is brought to you by the good people at Blue Apron. They've been a great sponsor for this podcast for a while. So go check out this week's menu by going to blueapron.com/military. You will love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals, so don't wait. Go to the website right now. Part of this week's menu is udon noodle soup with miso and soft-boiled eggs. There's no chance I make this if I'm not a member of Blue Apron. Just no chance. I may be making peanut butter and jelly or eggs for dinner. Would have no idea how to make this meal. But with Blue Apron, it's really pretty easy to do. Their recipes all come on large, like 8x11 sheets of paper. They have step-by-step instructions with photographs. So it's not like looking at an old recipe book where it's just words all written out. It's really great food. It's fresh, it comes directly to your house, and it introduces you to entirely new meals. Like I said, there's no way I make udon noodle soup without Blue Apron. So go there, give Blue Apron a try, and that helps Military Justice stay on the air. That's blueapron.com/military. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. What do you see as the major trends for the UCMJ, the United States military justice system?
That's a terrific question, and it requires an assessment of the latest package of changes. The latest package of changes certainly worked a number of improvements over the UCMJ as it has come down to us from 1950 when it was originally enacted. But it doesn't change the operating system, and that gets to the most fundamental question, which is this really a system that is properly described as owned and operated by commanders, as the Army JAG School materials say? They have a guide for commanders that says that. Or should it be a system that is independent of the chain of command, at least for offenses that are not what let's call disciplinary offenses? So this whole question of commander centric military justice is, to me, the major issue as we plunge into the 21st century. And, you know, we're going to see whether that's going to get anybody's attention in a real way and lead to more profound changes in the code, or whether we're going to continue with this system, which in the critical respects, bears the markings of the system that we inherited from George III. That, to me, is the most fundamental question. And as you know, there have been efforts prompted by the concern over sexual assault in the armed forces to move away from a commander-centric charging system, you know, who gets prosecuted for what, to a system where the charging decision is made by lawyers independent of the chain of command. Senator Gillibrand had a bill called the Military Justice Improvement Act that got a majority in the Senate, but as we all know, 51 is not a majority in that body. 60 is a majority of 100. So, you know, that bill is...
I was told there would be no math today.
Sir, right.
No, you're right. Right. And I believe Senator Gillibrand's bill is at least twice died on the vine by getting just a simple majority.
Yeah, well, that's true. On the other hand, Senator Gillibrand is a relatively young legislator. I have no reason to believe she's going to give up on this.
Oh, no.
And to lay my cards on the table for the handful of people that don't know what my cards are on this subject, I hope her bill passes or something like it. I thought that that particular fix, the shift towards control of the charging or disposition decision for non-disciplinary offenses, I'm talking about really criminal offenses, away from commanders and towards judge advocates outside the chain of command, is a shift that we should make. It would bring us into step with other democratic countries with which we share important values. I mean, one of the wonderful ironies is there's a sense in which, and I think I make this point in the book that you were nice enough to mention, that we're more Catholic than the Pope, more royalist than the King on this subject, because we got this commander-centric system from George III's 1774 Articles of War, but the Brits gave it up. So we're holding on to this antique, this museum piece, at a time when its inventors have moved on. Ditto for Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, Israel, South Africa, and on around the world. So, you know, it's not a question of fighting the last war. It's a question of, like, smelling the coffee. This is where the values of a democratic society, I think, point in this era. So we'll find out.
And I believe the last major hearing we had on this was in 2013 before the Senate Armed Services Committee. We had all of the service chiefs and all of their JAGs. From my recollection, they were really lockstep in wanting to maintain a commander-centric charging decision.
Well, that's the way the testimony went down. A friend told me that there was at least one person on that panel who actually didn't believe what he said. That's neither here nor there, but that's what I was... Washington is great, isn't it? Everything leaks. But yeah, there it was, and they're entitled to do that. And I thought it was a very unimpressive sort of... ipso facto, you know, how could it be any other way? Bit of testimony is utterly unpersuasive to me. And, you know, others will not view it that way. But that's my view. And to quote the president, if you don't agree with me, see you in court.
In front of a so-called judge? Is that what we say? Yeah, I'll tell you, I feel the same way about that testimony because, and this is something I've harped on for a number of years, is that the commanders will say that they absolutely have to have jurisdiction over all courts-martial. But I know in the Marine Corps, there's not a real rhyme or reason for when we give jurisdiction over to the civilians. You could take the murder of Lance Corporal Lauterbach down in North Carolina a few years ago. She was murdered by a fellow service member. She was found in his backyard, and the Marine Corps took no steps to even try that case. It was just given over to North Carolina. So it's questionable when you have the service chief say that we absolutely need this for good order and discipline. When you have, I mean, there's nothing more to the point of good order and discipline than murdering a fellow service member, and they just abrogate that responsibility and give it over to civilians and seem content to do so.
Right. At the time Senator Gillibrand's bill was under consideration, I started making an Excel spreadsheet of the various justifications that, let's say, the authorities were putting out, the authorities and their allies in the civilian world were putting out. And it was all sort of circular. We need it because we need it, referring to the command control of the charging process. And by the way, I mean, even if you could, you know, somehow get yourself to embrace the idea that the charging decision has to be made by a commander rather than somebody with a law degree and independent of the chain of command, our system has the commander making the jury selections. Another, thanks very much, George III, you know,
and calls on witnesses and experts and, you know, assigning the judge. I mean, I don't think members of the general public always understand how involved the commander is.
Well, assigning the judge is, I think that's been taken care of, frankly.
Right, true. That's fair.
Yeah, but the commanders have, take pretrial agreements. You know, you have to negotiate with the commander. You're probably actually negotiating with the staff judge advocate. You know, and who is actually driving the train is sometimes a mystery. But the collection of powers, I mean, granting immunity. The same person that makes the charging decision turns out to be picking the jury and granting immunity and making plea deals. I mean, you know, that combination of things is, I think, toxic. But even if you set all those other things aside, let's just get down to basics. The charging decision is a type of decision that ought to be made by an attorney. We're in the 21st century. These are legal issues, the evaluation of evidence. Now, what I want to add, Weyrich, is this. There's no reason why a system couldn't be put in place where you had an independent and impartial chief prosecutor, maybe a one-star, for example, like General Martin's in the military commissions, making these decisions. And if the command had a view on the matter, send the memo and send a copy to the defense counsel. You'll get your word in. Ditto for the victim. If the victim, you know, has an opinion on how a charge should be disposed of, send the memo and send a copy to the defense counsel. It's easy to do this. This is not rocket surgery.
Speaking of surgery, I've always found this similar, that if you can understand, giving the other side their due, you can understand the commander would want input on this. You know, the part of military justice is to ensure good order and discipline. But it's really the mechanics that I think that we disagree with having the commander so involved in. And if you took this into the realm of surgery, you would not want the commander saying, okay, you know, I've done my life as a helicopter pilot. We're going to do surgery today, and I think we need to remove the kidney. And not involve the physician and saying, well, nah, you know, sir, it's not really the kidney that needs to go. Listen, I think I'm pretty schooled up on this. Let's get that kidney out of here.
Yeah. Let me just inject a thought. It's important to recognize that there are different kinds of conduct that are proscribed by the UCMJ in the so-called punitive articles, some of which really are what, you know, in our society are considered criminal matters. And you could make a case that being out of uniform or being AWOL is something that, you know, a commander ought to have the whip hand on. And, you know, maybe it turns into NJP, who knows. But for offenses that, you know, resonate, that are the equivalent, they may be identical with offenses known to federal or state criminal law, like murder, arson, rape, and the like, that's not a question of good order and discipline. That's a question of punishing crime.
Absolutely. And I've used the dividing line, and I know that some of my critics will say this, we don't use these terms, but the felony or misdemeanor crimes, so your felonious crimes that murder, we're trying to keep that person away from society. For example, the Marine that was convicted of murdering Lance Corporal Lauterbach. We're not trying to set the example for that unit that we shouldn't kill our fellow Marines. We are trying to place that person outside of society and imprison him for as long as is appropriate.
Well, you know, to take a really timely example, a lot of the throughput of the military justice system today and for the last 20 years has had to do with pornography, child pornography.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, what does that have to do with good order and discipline, aside from the fact that we don't want our troops being weird and engaging in conduct that hurts children, because that's the theory? But look, the federal government has taken care of this, and states have taken care of this. There's laws on the books that are really draconian laws. They're terribly, you know, tough laws. So, you know, why is that kind of stuff cluttering up the military justice system?
Military Justice is brought to you by the fine people of Casper Mattress. The Casper is an obsessively engineered mattress at a shockingly fair price. It combines supportive memory foams to create an award-winning sleep surface with just the right sink and just the right bounce. With over 20,000 reviews and an average of 4.8 stars on Amazon, it's quickly becoming the internet's favorite mattress. Free shipping and returns in the US and Canada. Try Casper for 100 nights risk-free in your own home. If you don't love the mattress, they'll pick it up and refund you everything. Designed, developed, and assembled in the United States. So please go to Casper Mattress. That's www.casper.com/military and get $50 towards any purchase. And thank you to the fine people of Casper. Now back to Military Justice.
Can I change the subject?
You may do anything you'd like, Professor. within the realm of reason, I guess. I mean, we can't time travel, but please change the subject.
Well, we will time travel in a second, but before I get to time travel, I want to just mention one other thing. The other day in preparing for class, because I'm teaching military justice this semester at Yale Law School, where I hang out.
How long have you been teaching at Yale?
I started in 1993. I got a call out of the blue by the deputy dean at the time. Yale Law School had a tradition dating to the Vietnam era that they wanted to offer a military justice class. It had been taught by a man named Joseph Bishop, who wrote a famous book on military justice. When he died, or retired and then died, the course fell into disuse, and somebody thought, we really ought to be offering this. And so I taught it a few times as an adjunct, and then 8 years ago, I was asked to come and teach full-time, as was my wife, who also teaches at Yale, and I give the course every year. Anyway, in preparing for class the other day, I thought I would obtain the reports of the branches of the service on, you know, how many cases they have and outcomes and how many non-judicial punishments. And it's very interesting. One thing that jumps out at me is how few summary courts martial there are. And of course, we know from Middendorf against Henry from the 70s that they're not really courts, so don't worry about the right to counsel and all that stuff. But it does occur to me that the system could lose the summary court-martial and be perfectly fine, thank you.
I definitely agree with that. And for our listeners, summary court it's an administrative measure lower than an actual trial. It would be more akin to, like if you had in the NFL, the Deflategate type hearing. It is an administrative matter that can be taken care of by the commander. And absolutely, I think the merging of non-judicial punishment and summary court-martial would streamline the process and also assist in just the nomenclature. I mean, I think we get hung up on that a lot.
That's true. I have to drop in a little bit of trivia. In learning about some of the foreign military justice systems, it came to my attention that in the UK, when an officer is given their equivalent of non-judicial punishment, it is called an interview without coffee.
Oh, is it? Is it?
You could just imagine
a sand beverage.
How chilly that conversation
right.
is! No, Lieutenant, there's no need to sit down.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And for that matter, since you're a Marine and you know the inside scoop, I just love the fact that the Marine Corps calls non-judicial punishment office hours. A wonderful, wonderful phrase.
Right, yes.
So I threatened you with some time travel. And I'll just mention what I'm reading now. I'm actually rereading a book I read a number of years ago and it's the rare book you can read more than once and enjoy it more the second time than the first time. But it's a book by a man named Istvan Diak. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. D-E-A-K, who taught for many years at Columbia. And the title of the book, which Oxford University Press, my publisher, will be happy to sell you, is Beyond Nationalism, : A Social and Political History of the Habsburg Officer Corps, 1848 to 1918. And it is completely fascinating. I just read the section about dueling. Everybody who knows anything about military justice knows that, you know, there's a provision about dueling, just as there's a provision about abusing a public animal.
Right, right.
These wonderful, 18th century things. And the section on dueling is fascinating. It was discouraged because a lot of people were being killed in these duels. There was a whole body of jurisprudence around dueling and also honor. You know, what you had to do if your honor was impugned if you were an officer. So, you know, in theory, if somebody insulted you, they were insulting the uniform, the army, and, you know, His Imperial Majesty, the Kaiser. So what you had to do was have your sword ready at all times and draw it and, you know, basically, let me say, make the point. And it was invalid. It was insufficient as a defense of your honor if you had to reach over and get your sword off a hook on the wall.
that you had not done your job if you had taken it off at any time.
Right, right, right. What's also interesting is that their system was not a particularly bloodthirsty system. There were, you know, numerous death sentences, but they were rarely carried out. The Kaiser granted a lot of clemency. Who knew? The Austrian Kaiser, not the German Kaiser. One of the major sanctions was to be kicked out of the regiment ignominiously. Anyway,
drummed out, as it were.
It's to be drummed out. And it's just a wonderful read, how they dealt with homosexuality. Very interesting. To a person who bothers about military justice, those seven of us.
We're recruiting eight. I'm recruiting a few out of the audience.
Okay. Yeah. But anyway, it's a wonderful read for military justice junkies.
Yeah, I'll definitely put that on my Audible reading list so it can be read to me as I commute around. So let's go back to the numbers. We were talking previously about, you said that very few summary courts-martial. But what about special or misdemeanor and general courts-martial?
Well, those numbers hold pretty firm. They're down. I mean, the number of appeals is way down. If you have a bumper crop at the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, you might be in the upper 30s for cases decided on full opinion in the course of a year. I mean, that raises some institutional issues, like whether it's worth the $13 or $14 million the taxpayers pay to have that court. An interesting question, by the way, which I always ask my students on the first day of classes, this is probably not a good idea, but I do ask students to do some homework at the beginning of this semester, and I ask them to read their selection, one or two cases from the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces last term, and come prepared to discuss whether you need a specialized court to decide those cases. I hope that listeners will do the same exercise and just pick one or two cases at random from CAF's decided cases, and ask whether you need a specialized court to decide these cases.
Yeah, that's a great assignment, and I'll make sure I put up in the show notes a link to that for the Court of Appeals. But they actually have a very user-friendly website now, and for the most part, their opinions are well-written and not overly long. But I agree with you that it is a good exercise to decide, is this a body of law that is so different from other federal or state law that you need specialized judges for this?
Yeah, it's interesting that, you know, after World War II, a number of the Western democracies created civilian courts-martial, because there were a lot of courts-martial in World War II, lots and lots, and GIs came back with serious questions about the fairness of the administration of justice, and many of those GIs got elected to Congress. That's the short version of why the UCMJ was enacted when it was. But one of the major reforms, obviously, was the creation of the then Court of Military Appeals, now the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, and similar courts were created in the UK, Canada, Australia, and so forth. What's interesting is those courts do not have separate rosters of judges. It's just in the UK, for example, the judges of the Court Martial Appeal Court which sees, you know, cases every now and again. They have a hot case right now for a sergeant in the Royal Marines named Alexander Blackman, who killed a wounded guy. The judges of that court are simply judges of the Court of Appeal and other, you know, senior judges in the UK system. Ditto for the Canadian Court Martial Appeal Court. They just have judges from the combination of judges from their federal court and federal court of appeal and provincial judges. Nobody, to my knowledge, has an appellate court, at least along these lines, a civilian appellate court with a dedicated membership. And of course, even in the U.S. system, we regularly see judges of the Article III, that is the civilian courts of appeals, sitting by designation when there's a vacancy or some judge has to recuse himself or herself. So, you know, clearly this is work that doesn't require specialized knowledge.
I'm going to go back to your answer there for a moment. And I believe it was in World War II, I think we had 1.8 million courts martial. And when I worked at the Navy Yard, it was the repository for all of those records of trial. And you could see the special courts martial, they would be recorded. The entire record would be on a card that was about 4 inches wide, 8 inches long. And it was on front and back. And that was the entire record of the proceeding. And I've always looked at that as illustrative of the military's unwillingness to want to change or modernize their military justice system. But we clearly have, and I can't see any evidence that says that makes us a less able fighting force.
I think our fighting force is in as good shape as it's ever been in. And I think that the system could be changed and updated and brought out of the George III model with no detriment whatever to good order and discipline or effectiveness, which, as we all know, is the ultimate purpose of having a military force and a military justice system. It's to contribute to national defense, no question about that.
And you'll also hear, and obviously you're aware of this, but you'll also hear the speed at which a court-martial can go is one of its major benefits. Have you ever seen any evidence of that? Do we have any data that says, you know, a court-martial goes this many days on average as compared to a similar civilian trial?
No, I never have. And, you know, it is possible for a system to dispense criminal justice quite promptly. I mean, anybody who has lived or practiced in the National Capital Area knows about the Rocket Docket, which is the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Virginia. Things move along very quickly. I think any assertion that the military justice system is needed in order to achieve fast justice, I'm not talking about for disciplinary matters, you know, Article 15 type matters. I'm talking about for, you know, serious criminality, is simply not borne out.
And we saw that in the Marine Corps with especially the Haditha cases. Those took 8 years at least.
Right, right. You know, there are times when cases simply do take a long time. But nonetheless, I think that is a problem. I think the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is alert to this. And they've labored, they struggled to move things along. If I can revert to something that you said, Wyrick, if I had a crystal ball, I would say, I'll say 10 years from now, maybe it'll be 15, you will see a collapsing of the special and general court-martial. Because with the increase in the maximum punishment power of the special court-martial, there's very little reason why you need two different forums. You know, the same rules of evidence apply, same right to counsel, same judge, and basically the same levels of serious penalties. Obviously, there's a difference between a one-year max and life or death, but still, I don't see why you actually need the complication. You could simply have something called the court-martial, which, by the way, is what they have in the UK now.
Well, and I think we've already seen that historically, because an officer cannot be dismissed at a special court-martial, we have really de facto officer cases just go to general courts-martial.
Well, yes, they go to general courts-martial, but there's another dimension to this, which is timely based on something I just read this morning, that at least senior officers are often punished outside the military justice system. through grade determinations.
Yes. So you're talking about now Brigadier General Lewis?
Well, he's an example. But, hardly a month goes by without, or let's say a quarter goes by, without some story about a very senior officer who has been penalized for a violation of the UCMJ, not in the context of a court-martial, but through losing a stripe or a star in retirement, the instance of retirement. They tried to do this to General Petraeus, but it was too late because General Petraeus was long gone. He was long retired by the time that all came to a head. And I have real difficulty with using the grade determination process as a surrogate for the UCMJ process. Call me old-fashioned in this respect, and I'll say, yeah, I am.
And there the grade determination at that point, because it's a forced retirement, is just penalizing with, okay, you lose $700 per month in your retirement. To say that that's punishment in the criminal sense is really a stretch.
Well, yeah, there's certainly a degree of disgrace involved. These are people who are probably not going to spend a lot of evenings at the Oak Club when they're retired because of, the reaction they may have. But anyway, it is concerning. And interestingly, there's a provision in the U.S. Code that applies, I believe, only to the Navy and the Marine Corps that says that a person should not be retired for something for which he or she could have been prosecuted. Obviously, it was in response to some abuse in the 19th century because it's been on the books for a long time. And it doesn't comport with the UCMJ, as the notes to this obscure section indicate. But listeners should be aware that you could have military justice outside the Uniform Code of Military Justice as a practical matter.
Absolutely. And I think that real serious argument, and if any military justice practitioner were to really seriously look at this, the feasibility of trying a three-star, to try a three-star general is, I believe, not possible. Just because of the logistics of doing it, your jury members, for the most part, are supposed to be senior, and just in paneling a jury for the trial of a three-star general, I don't believe is possible.
It certainly hasn't happened in my professional lifetime. I think the most senior officer that I know has been prosecuted in a court-martial is a two-star, and I can't think of anybody more senior than that.
But the federal government seems to be able to do it. They've done General Cartwright and General Petraeus with very little difficulty. I can't see, did we lose good order and discipline by having our brethren in the Article III federal courts take care of those two matters?
Well, that opens up a whole other issue, which is to what extent should we be concerned once a person has retired? On paper, at least, and in reality, our system does apply military justice sanctions under some circumstances to people who are retired. There's a death row case right now, Master Sergeant Hennis, who, for odd reasons and some poor decision-making on his part, wound up returning to military jurisdiction because he acquired retired status and wound up getting a death sentence as a result. And there are occasional cases where retirees are prosecuted. And I have to say that is not in keeping with current human rights standards around the world. It's a habit we ought to kick.
Well, and the Navy, I think, is the most egregious on this, with returning the admiral to active duty to be prosecuted for his lifestyle choices after retirement.
Right. Are you thinking of Admiral Hooper?
Yes, Admiral Hooper.
He actually was not recalled. He was simply prosecuted. He had been retired.
Right, right. Yeah, so it was almost in absentia to a certain extent, right?
Well, as a practical matter, I guess he showed up for trial, and I assume he wore a uniform at trial, but he wasn't on active duty when he was tried because he hadn't been recalled.
And that's the only time the Navy has ever tried an admiral, I believe.
Long pause. I can't think of another time. That's the case that's always cited in any event.
Right. And it seems that They've been quite happy to turn over all prosecutorial decisions in the Fat Leonard cases to the federal government.
Right. That's a very interesting situation that you may want to explore or explain a little with listeners. I think the reason for that, the short version is there was some corruption in Navy vessel support functions in the Far East. And I think the reason for those cases being handled outside the military justice system or naval justice system is because NCIS or somebody had sprung a leak and they were concerned about compromise of sensitive information.
You're right. For the listeners, Fat Leonard, I don't think it's a derogatory term. I think he applied it to himself. He ran a husbanding company, so they would help Navy ships in the Pacific when they came into a foreign port, you know, just resupplying. And he was very adept at getting at senior people and bending them to his will with drinking and going to lavish parties and possibly having the services of prostitutes. In fact, when I was at Quantico, our senior NCIS officer all of a sudden wasn't around one day, and he was taken by the FBI, and he ended up pleading guilty. I believe he received 12 years for giving over information about ship movements and other things to this contractor.
Right. This is something that people will want to keep an eye on because those cases are unfolding even as we speak. I did want to say this, by the way. I think public understanding of military justice is critical. And I want to, at the risk of sucking up, say how much I respect what you've been doing with your podcast and in other ways to provide, except for this segment, obviously, but provide through knowledgeable people insight into the system, its strengths, which are there for real, and the areas in which it could stand some improvement. And I think that is really in keeping with the highest tradition of the bar. And for this, you get the brass figlegee with bronze oak leaf cluster.
Well, I appreciate that, and my blushing is now gone over its normal level. But I'll tell you, my listenership, our listenership, they're very engaged, and they really have a thirst for this. Just on the last segment, or last episode, I had a great question from a listener asking about a current high-profile case, and if there was a finding of guilt in the case, would you want to choose military judge alone or members for sentencing? And I was just so impressed that having a listenership that knows that nuance and has questions about that. So I do agree that getting the information about the military justice system out to the general public is something that I think we all should strive towards. It shouldn't be this cloistered little side of the law. More people should know about how our service members are disciplined.
I think that's absolutely right. And unfortunately, you know, as fewer and fewer Americans actually have had the experience of wearing the uniform, there's a real danger, and that includes lawyers. There's a real danger of a decline in public understanding. And by public, I include our legislators and also our judges. You know, even within the active duty force, there are misconceptions that are rampant. My favorite is the ever popular myth that if you get a bad paper administrative discharge, it'll be upgraded in 30 days.
Right. Yes, that is a favorite myth.
One of the most pernicious and DDT resistant weeds in the legal garden that I've ever encountered. It just never goes away.
Well, we had a Navy case about 2 years ago where one of the panel members stated her opinion that it was the burden was on the accused to prove his or her innocence in the military justice system. And that was a Navy commander.
And I think she was a captain. I think she was a medical officer, or she was a staff officer, not line, I believe. It was astounding to me that a person could reach that level in the hierarchy with such a fundamental misconception.
What was more astounding to me was the convening authority who read that in her members' questionnaire and still selected her to be a member of that jury.
Right. You know, the thing about member selection, which we talked about previously, it's so easy to do this in an independent way. You just have a jury commissioner with access and just get it outside the command structure.
Right. And so that it becomes more of just a ministerial act for you just look at the roster of whatever installation and say, okay, here's the potential jury pool, and not dealing with the individuals, just that they are more almost like numbers, I guess.
Yeah, I have to point of quibble on that. I mean, as long as Congress is going to say the people on the panel should be best qualified by age, experience, education, judicial temperament, and so forth, there's five or six factors. As long as you have that, you're not going to be able to do like random selection of juries. There's some judgment involved. But even that judgment could be made by a person who isn't responsible for the command climate, for example. Just have a jury commissioner.
Right. While you still have your crystal ball out.
I'm working on it with my Brasso. I'm almost out of breath.
What do you see the future of the Military Justice Improvement Act, Senator Gillibrand's legislation?
There are two possibilities. There are three. Well, one is that it's dead and it's going to stay dead. The second is it will revive over the long haul. We're talking 10 years out. A third is that some critical incident will occur, which could happen this afternoon.
Right.
That will cause Congress to come to its senses on this subject. And that's completely unknowable.
That's not enough. You have to give us the knowing answer, please.
Yeah.
Please,
yeah,
do.
My knowing answer is send more Brasso.
Well, you know what? I think that's a nice ending for our conversation today. But before we go, tell us where the listeners can follow you. The listeners are great, especially Twitter, social media. They're very engaged. Where can they keep up with you and what you're doing?
I do have a Facebook page, which people are, you know, more than welcome to follow. Most of it is, you know, not particularly deep. But the blog that I edit, called Global Military Justice Reform, or globalmjreform.blogspot.com, you know, will sort of indirectly share with the readers, and at times directly, what's on my mind.
That site also has a dedicated Twitter account, correct?
It does have a dedicated Twitter account, and I'm becoming, in this age where we are led by the tweeter-in-chief, I guess I have to get more... I have to become more of a twit.
Yes, I did. I was not aware that we were going to get all of our pronouncements out of Twitter, but it does seem that's the world we're living in. But
you know what we need, Wyrick?
What is that?
You're a lawyer.
Yes, I play one on television.
We need to get the editors of the Harvard Blue Book, you know, the Uniform System of Citation,
yes,
to give us how to cite a tweet. That's your homework, Wyrick. Check the Blue Book and see if they've taken care of it. And if not, I want that done tomorrow.
Will do. That's right. That is a very important thing to get done. And I will make sure I put that in all the show notes. I can't thank you enough for being on today. And I hope you have a fantastic rest of your day.
Oh, it's going to go downhill from here. This is really a high point, and I've really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for letting me talk.
Now I need to thank everyone who makes Military Justice possible. First, audio. These are the people that clean up all my mistakes and make the podcast sound as great as it does. The team is headed by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media. You may know Rebecca from her other excellent podcasts, Crime Writers On, and These Are Their Stories, the Law and Order podcast. You can find links to both of these in the show notes. And Rebecca is assisted by Hannah McCarthy and the strapping young Henry Lavoie. The executive producer of Military Justice is Dennis Robinson. You will also remember Dennis from his wearing of underwear and other announcements on Undisclosed. And as always, my Uber producer Dreadnought has my six. Thank you to all of you for making Military Justice possible.